My name is Ted Bradford. I live in Washington State. I was wrongly convicted in 1996. Spent 10 years in prison. Continued to fight my case and was finally granted a retrial in 2008. And the retrial was granted based on new DNA evidence that wasn't available at the time of the first trial in 1996. So the state of Washington granted my rights to a new trial. The state actually then decided to retry me on the same charges from 1996. And after a two-week trial, I was finally acquitted on all charges and exonerated. My exoneration happened in 2010.
Hi, I'm Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and problems in the justice system. I'm here with DeMarco. How are you doing this week, DeMarco?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm doing fabulous. I'm doing fabulous. And you know why that is?
Why is that?
Because something that we helped create, Leslie Vass, he will be attending the Innocence Conference in Memphis next month. And I'm very excited about it.
I was emailing with him. I helped him fill out the online registration and book his flight because he had never done those things before. And he was just so appreciative and he's so excited. So I am also really excited that he gets to go.
And we have you to thank, Brooke. Thank you.
Well, and we have the listeners to thank. So thank you for donating.
Oh, yes, definitely thank the listeners. And also Kimberly Long. You know who Kimberly Long is, don't you?
Yes, Kimberly Long, the woman that we interviewed from California.
Yes, I recall us interviewing her. She said it was a possibility that she would possibly have to go back to prison depending on her outcome.
Right.
But she was awaiting an appeal. And, this past week?
I think it was the beginning of last Tuesday.
Yeah, she had to be in court.
And they were talking about how she could potentially have to go back in until she got another trial, but she did end up getting to go home. So I was really glad about that.
Yeah, excited. And the listeners, y'all can go help Kimberly. If y'all go to Justin Long's page, he has, the address and phone number to the governor and other people that you can reach out to concerning Kimberly's innocence in her, staying on the streets.
Do you know the address to that page?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, I'll put it in the show note link. So look for it in the description of this podcast and you'll just be able to click on it.
Yes.
So I have some trivia, but first, why don't you tell who our sponsor is for today?
Today our show is sponsored by ZipRecruiter.
Are you hiring? Posting your position to job sites and waiting for the right people to see it? I found the smartest way to hire is by using ZipRecruiter.
ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job.
Yeah, and they even review every application to identify the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. That's what makes ZipRecruiter different.
In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site in just one day. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them.
Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. That's ZipRecruiter.com/actual.
ZipRecruiter.com/actual. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Our guest today is Ted Bradford, who I believe is our first guest from Washington State. So today's trivia questions are about the Innocence Project Northwest Clinic, based at the University of Washington School of Law. DeMarco, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay, question one. It's multiple choice. The Innocence Project Northwest Clinic has exonerated 14 people. what is the total number of years that those people spent incarcerated, like if you add them all together? A, over 50, B, over 100, or C, over 200?
I'm going to say B, over 100.
That's right. The answer is B. Over 100 years were lost by people who were wrongly convicted, time that they can't get back.
Insane.
It is. So the next question. In the past 2 years, the Innocence Project Northwest Clinic has had around 1,000 requests for help. How many cases do they currently have under an active investigation? A, 29, B, 39, or C, 49?
C, 49.
Yeah, the answer is 49, which is incredible to me. I sometimes struggle when I'm researching multiple cases for podcasts. I can't imagine 49 active investigations going on simultaneously. So for this last question, I want to try something new for the listeners. I'm going to send some actual innocent swag to the first 10 listeners that email me the correct answer and a shipping address to this question. So the question is, students from the Innocence Project Northwest Clinic have presented oral arguments in state trials, appellate courts, and in the Federal Court of Appeals. One of those arguments were interpreting a Latin phrase meaning significant change in the law. What is the Latin phrase?
Wait, how do listeners get actual innocent swag?
For the chance to get some swag in the mail, listeners need to email me the answers to the questions and an address where the swag should be mailed. The swag will go out to the first 10 listeners that respond from any country. The answer has to come in the form of an email to actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. Answers sent via Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram and other social media won't count. So DeMarco, who is kind of our public relations guy, was the one who contacted Ted about the interview. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I actually reached out to Ted last year, back in December. He wasn't ready at the time, but I was going through my inbox and looking for our next interview candidate. And, you know, I stopped at his text and, you know, I just reached out to him and he was ready. Ted, everyone.
I was born and raised in Great Falls, Montana, and most of my childhood was spent there. I moved to Washington State to live with my father in around 1984, 1985, and started going to school here, and I've lived in Yakima ever since then, not counting the time in prison, which I was moved around quite a bit all over the state. Different prisons. Actually, I was also sent down to Colorado in the year 2000, about midway through my sentence. And that was because of the overcrowding in the Washington prison system. So they sent about 400, 500 inmates to Colorado to do their time there. I have three brothers and three sisters, so pretty big family.
And what kind of things did you like to do as a kid?
Getting into trouble and stuff like that, you know, just usual kid stuff. You know, we were quite a wild bunch when we were younger. But, you know, just riding bikes all over town and, you know, playing sports and stuff like that. I got involved with music when I was about 13 years old. I started playing guitar. Didn't really take it seriously, though, until probably about my mid-20s, while I was incarcerated, actually, so I figured I had plenty of time to improve on my guitar playing, so I took advantage of that while I was in prison.
You were falsely accused of a crime in 1995, correct?
The crime happened in 1995. I was accused and arrested and put on trial in 1996.
What was your life like in early 95 and 94? Like, what were you doing at that time with your life?
At that time, I was married. We had two small kids. They were both under 2 years of age. I had a good job working for a wood mill plant where they made wood products. And for instance, like the molding around, you know, like the trim of the baseboards and stuff like that for houses. So I had a good job, you know, 401k program, the benefits, health insurance and all that. And life was going, you know, pretty good until they brought me in to question me about this crime that had happened.
How old were you?
I was 22.
I need you to help me understand the timeline. In September of 1995, a woman was raped. And then 6 months later, in April, you were arrested for something totally unrelated. And then that was when they tried to connect you to that rape?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. For whatever reason, the police and the detectives investigating the rape crime felt that I was responsible for that as well. So they had me in a small interrogation room at the police station. And originally they had asked me, we are investigating this crime and we thought you could help us with it. So I thought I was there just to help them in any way I could, you know. And so I went with them and told them, well, sure, it's fine. I'll answer a few questions or whatever. Unfortunately, we get into this small room at the police station, and they just immediately started accusing me of raping this woman. And it was just relentless. It went on for the full day. It was over 9 hours of interrogation.
Dang. Do you know what made them suspect you of the rape?
I do not. It still boggles my mind to this day. Because there were definitely other leads that they should have looked into. And I don't know if you guys are aware of the update on my case. They got a DNA hit on the evidence that was left at the crime scene by the perpetrator.
The brother-in-law, right?
Yes, it came back as a 100% match for the brother-in-law.
Wow.
And actually, the victim in her initial statement to police said, like half a dozen times, that this guy looked just like her brother-in-law. She thought it was him playing a joke on her originally, and then they never looked into that. So I still don't understand why they targeted me and went after me and forced me to confess to something I didn't do.
I heard something shady that your wife had hired an attorney for you, but he was turned away. Did I understand that right?
Yes. While I was at the police station, my wife at the time, she was trying to figure out where I was at, because she went down to bail me out from the jail because I was arrested on those misdemeanor crimes. So she showed up at the jail to bail me out, and they told her that they had no idea where I was at. So she went to the city hall, I guess, or the public defender's office, trying to find out who my attorney would be. And they said it's Mr. Wes Raber. So he goes down to the city jail trying to find me, because he knew something was going on. He knew something was up, why they couldn't find me. It turns out that, you know, they took me from the city jail to another part of town where they had just built the new police station. So they took me from the jail over to this new police station, and that's where they were questioning me, and that's where they held the interrogation. And when my attorney showed up, he demanded to see me. He said, I demand to see my client. And they said, well, he doesn't want to talk to you. We told him you're here, and he doesn't want to see you, which was a lie. If I had known that I had an attorney right on the other side of that door, things would have been different. You know, he would have told me, you know, do not speak with these detectives, invoke your right.
That's odd for them to say, you know, he doesn't want to speak with you, for them to tell your attorney that. You know, it was something fishy up from right there, right then, from the gate.
Right. And also, I was supposed to be in court before the end of that day for the misdemeanor charges. And it says in the court rules, I looked this up while I was incarcerated and trying to figure out what happened, what went wrong. in the court rules, it states that when you're arrested, you're supposed to be before a judge before the close of the next business day. Well, what they did was they called the city attorney's office and told them, hey, look, we're interrogating this guy, but he has a court date. And they told him, well, go ahead and continue with the interrogation. We'll just set his court date over for the next day. So there was a lot of shadiness involved. And sadly, it was upheld by the Court of Appeals when I appealed my case.
I heard that your interrogation was so intense that you had made a false confession or you had made a statement that seemed like it implicated you.
Well, that's exactly right. They put me through this very intense interrogation. I mean, it was very hostile. One of the detectives, if I remember right, he was about 6'8" tall and very menacing. Anytime I told them that I didn't do this, they would just scream in my face, we know you did this. You need to start telling us the truth. At one point, they asked if I would be willing to take a polygraph, and I said yes. You know, I have nothing to hide. I'm telling you guys the truth. So they brought in another detective to give me the polygraph test, and at the end of that, you know, I thought I did fine. You know, I told the truth. I wasn't lying to them. But at the end of it, they lied to me again and said that I failed it.
Did they ever physically put their hands on you?
No, it was all psychological. You know, there were times where they would like slam their fists on the table in front of me. The way I was situated in this small room was my back was to the wall and there was a small table in front of me. And they were directly across from me. So I was, you know, cornered, my back to the wall, and I had these two detectives, you know, just constantly accusing me and saying that I did this when I didn't.
Did they ask you the same questions in a variety of ways?
Yes, they would.
Yeah, they're good at that.
They would ask me questions about, you know, like, how did you get in the house? Things like that. Things about the crime. And when I tell them, yeah, I wasn't in the house, you know, a little while later, they would come back with the same question, only, you know, rephrased or worded in a different way. And that's, you know, as that day went on, they repeatedly told me, you are not leaving this room until you tell us what happened. Even though I kept telling them I wasn't there, you know, I didn't do this, they made it clear that I wasn't going to leave that room until then. And here I am, 22 years old. I've never been in a situation like this before. I had no idea exactly what my rights were, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's easier to say now, ask for an attorney, tell them you want an attorney. But at that moment, I was so scared, I didn't know what I should do.
You're not alone, because we've heard very similar stories. I just told them what they wanted to hear because I wanted to go home.
And that's one of the things that they kept telling me, too, was at one point they had asked me, well, what's important to you? I said, my family and my work. And they would tell me over and over, well, if you just give us a statement, we'll get you back home to your family and go to work tomorrow.
You were working when the crime was committed, but there was some kind of time card mishap. Is that, can you explain that to me?
Yeah. When I was arrested in that interrogation, when they were asking me where I was on this date, you know, 6 months prior, you know, I had no idea at first. I was like, well, what day of the week was that? They said it would have been a Friday. So at that time, you know, I was working Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturday. And they told me it happened at like 9 or 10 in the morning. So I told them, well, if it was on a Friday at that time, I would have been at work. And so they again lied to me and said, well, we called your work. They said you were missing that day. But I have, and I still have them, actually, the copies of my time card that shows that I was paid for that day, my paycheck stub that shows I was paid for that day. There was also a call-in sheet where the office would record if somebody called in and, you know, whatever reason it was, if they were sick or if they had a doctor's appointment. There was nothing written in that log about me calling in. And in addition to that, my direct supervisor had a notebook that he kept in his pocket. And for that day, nowhere in there is it written Ted Bradford called in or didn't show up. There was other entries in his pocketbook that said, like, so-and-so was late, this person called in. This person went to the bathroom for 15 minutes. Things like that were written in his notebook, but nothing about me being gone. And so there was this, I felt there was plenty of evidence to prove my alibi, more or less. I had alibi evidence. But the one thing that they couldn't, and we still can't figure out what happened, was in the office, there was like a yearly, like a each employee had a sheet that had the whole year mapped out when they had absences or vacation time or whatever. And for some reason, somebody had written a zero on that date. And not, and if you look at the other entries on that same page, if they were absent, they were supposed to be an A. But for some reason, somebody had written a zero there. And that's where the police that were investigating, that's where they used that to say that I was not at work.
Mm-hmm. What were your charges?
Despite all that other.
Hmm? What were your charges?
I was charged with first-degree rape and first-degree burglary.
So help me out. First-degree means that it wasn't planned. What does first-degree mean?
I think, if I remember from the charging, the papers that they gave me when they charged me, it was because this person had entered a dwelling or a building where the victim was located. And so that's okay. Why there was a burglary charge as well.
And so were you arrested on that same day that you were given the polygraph, or at what point were you arrested?
Yeah, that very same day. They booked me in the county jail. My bail was $250,000, so my family definitely couldn't put up the money to get me out.
So did you finally get to talk to your attorney?
I think it was, yes, I did finally get to talk to him, and it was it was the next day, actually, because that interrogation went on until, like, I think around 6 p.m. was when they finally took me back to the jail.
And was he a public defender, or was he hired?
He was a public defender.
And what was your relationship with him like? Did you feel like he had... I feel oftentimes public defenders get a bad rap, but did you feel like he had enough time to spend with you and investigate your case?
I think he did. And he was a great attorney. And when he came to see me the next day, when I told him what happened, you could just see the expression on his face. He just hung his head and he shook his head and he's like, you know, I can't believe they did this to you. He knew what was up. He was an older man, and I think he'd been around for quite a while in the public defender's office. So I think he knew from the start what was going on, and that's why he was trying to get in to see me. I think he knew what was happening.
That's great, though. Someone who cares.
How long were you in the county?
About 9 or 10 months.
Was that your first time in the county jail?
No, actually, I did like a night in jail back when I was 18 for I had actually gotten into a fight with my older brother.
Things that kids do.
Like I said, we were pretty crazy. So, but that was just for one night in 1996. I was in there for 9 months, and part of that was I was sued by the victim and her husband. Instead of sending me straight to prison, I had a civil trial that I had to be there for. So they just kept me there in a county jail, waiting for the civil trial to go through.
How long did you have to wait for your criminal trial?
I think it was 3 months, 2 or 3 months.
When you were charged with this crime here, how did your family respond to the charges?
They were devastated. None of us could understand what was going on, why I had been accused and why I was arrested. And I remember I called my mom like the next day and told her what happened. You know, these detectives forced me to confess to something I didn't do. And they have always believed in my innocence. They knew I couldn't have done this. So it was devastating. My wife at the time, she went through hell, and so did my two kids.
Yeah, because I can imagine it must have been hard. You confessed. Okay, you knew that you were innocent, and the cops, you know, they knew that they had coerced you or made you into confessing, but you knew that you, dang, I confessed to this and I didn't do it. That must have been hard on you, and then for your family, but they still believed in you, right? They was like, no, he couldn't have done this.
Well, and just your kids were little, so I imagine that it was very confusing to them what was happening.
Yes, it was. It was very hard on them. And it continued to be so even when they got older. Like, for instance, when I was released in 2005, I completed my sentence, but I still wasn't exonerated at that time. We're still trying to get back in the courts to clear my name. So when I was released, the city of Yakima, where I live, they had flyers sent out to like all the schools with my picture, my name on there. Level 3 sex offender is moving to Yakima. And, of course, my kids have the same last name. So they had the worst time having to deal with that. Sometimes, kids could be pretty mean to one another, and
Definitely.
they had it pretty rough.
Was there any evidence presented besides the coerced confession?
No. It all hung on the false confession. And like I was saying, the alibi evidence, the jury just chose to believe the confession over that.
Your attorney's strategy was to prove that you weren't there.
Right.
How long did the trial last?
I think it was like 2.5 weeks.
Did you testify?
Yes, I took the stand in both of my trials.
That's very brave.
It was pretty difficult too, because your life is hanging in the balance, and going through those two trials were I can't even explain how terrifying that was.
Did the victim, did she testify against you? Did she point you out?
No, she never did. When she testified, the prosecutor had asked her, "Does this look like the man that attacked you?" And she said, "Well, it kind of does." And I remember the prosecutor asking her, "Well, what looks similar?" And the only thing she said was, "Well, his neck looks kind of similar."
Your neck.
Yeah.
That sounds very scientific.
Sounds ridiculous.
And there was a huge height difference, right? Like she described the attacker being very tall, and you were less tall than what she described, right?
Right. I like that. Less tall.
I'm 5'2", so I understand being less tall.
So you have a short neck.
So I'm 5'7", and she described the attacker as being like 6'1 or 6'2".
DeMarco, how tall are you? Like 6'5"?
6'5".
So how long did the jury deliberate?
I don't really remember the first trial in 1996. I know it was like overnight, though, because I remember they kept me in a holding cell at the courthouse. And then when they didn't have a verdict, I remember I had to go back to my cell. So probably a day for the first trial. But when they retried me in 2010, the jury was out for less than 5 hours. And they came back with the acquittal and not guilty verdict.
What was your original sentence? How much time did you get?
They sentenced me to 122 months, which is basically 10 years. And I actually, like I said, I did that whole time while I was waiting for the appeals to go through.
And you said you were moved around a lot too, like you went to a lot of different facilities?
Right. In Washington State, they have like a classification system based on your level of security. Like they start you out with maximum custody. And for that, I was at Walla Walla. But when my custody level changed, they moved me to Airway Heights, which is over by Spokane. And from there, I went to Colorado because of the overcrowding problem. And after that, I was moved back to Washington State and ended up at Stafford Creek, which is over by Aberdeen. And that's where I spent the rest of my time until I was released.
We have a lot of listeners that are from the UK or Australia. Can you explain how far is it from Colorado to Washington?
It's probably like at least a 20-hour drive.
How did that affect your relationship with the people on the outside, like with your children and your family?
Oh, it was terrible because before they sent me down there, I was getting regular visits, you know, from my wife at the time and our kids. They sent me to Colorado, and there's just no way they could make that trip to come see me.
What was prison like for you?
It was very harsh. I can't even describe it.
I've heard that people who are accused of rape sometimes are bullied or singled out by the other inmates. Did anything like that happen to you?
From time to time, it would. Actually, when I was in county jail still, before I got sent to the prison system, my wife got the idea from another inmate's wife because they would be in the waiting room waiting to visit their inmate. This wife told my wife, well, see if you could make paperwork. Because, like, when you go to prison, it's expected that you have your paperwork showing what your charges are. So what my wife had done was she worked in an office, so she had kind of doctored up my paperwork to show that I was in for first-degree assault. So for years, that really saved me from, you know, being targeted. Eventually, you know, people find out, word gets out, and have to face that, you know, when it comes. I got into a few fights here and there over it, but luckily I was never seriously injured.
And we've touched on this a couple of times, but you served your time, and then you were released on, and I quoted this from something that I read, that it was on community supervision. Is that like parole? Is that how that works?
Right. It's like the new phrasing for parole. So it was like kind of like a probation also, because I had to report once a month to the probation office and meet with a probation officer. I had to update them if I moved anywhere. I was subject to random searches of my house, random UAs, anything like that. It was pretty much like a probation. I don't know why they call it community custody, but same thing.
In my former life, I used to work as a therapist, and the practice that I worked at specialized in treating people who had been accused of sexual crimes. And so they had limitations, like some people weren't even allowed to use the internet. And, you know, they had to register so everybody in their neighborhood knew who they were. Did you have those kind of restrictions as well?
No, I didn't have a computer or anything or a cell phone or anything like that at that time. So I didn't.
Right.
Maybe they did, but I just wasn't aware of it. But I was on that community custody for 2 years after I was released. So from 2005 to 2007, I was on that.
What were the steps that led to your exoneration? Like, who did you contact and when did that whole process start?
Well, for me, and it was 2001. My brother Brian sent me a letter and he included a questionnaire packet from the Seattle Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. And he told me in this letter, he said, well, fill this out and send it off. Maybe these people could help you. And so I did. I filled it out. About 6 months later, I heard from them. They said they were interested in my case. They wanted me to send them whatever I had, you know, as far as like case files, trial transcripts and stuff like that. So I sent all this stuff off to them. In probably about a year, in 2002, they started working on my case, trying to get testing done on crime scene evidence, things like that, trying to file appeals and stuff.
No, I'd like to know. I want to know what kept you motivated and sane and strong throughout your year, your incarceration. Because I was in prison for a long time and I seen how guys that was charged with rape, how they, you know, carried themselves. And I've met some guys that was exonerated and it was very hard. When I speak to them in person, one-on-one, they tell me it was real hard because they had to go through so much. What did you do to stay focused?
For me, it was, I had to stay busy. I was always doing something, whether it be like music or sports or craft stuff. Music was the biggest part of it, though. For me, it really helped me get through that.
I'm curious to know, did you have any access to any type of, like a guitar or anything?
Yeah, actually, when I was at Stafford Creek, I think it was around 2001, about the time I was writing for the Innocence Project, my mom was actually able to buy a guitar from a mailing company, and they shipped it to the prison, and they allowed me to have it in my cell. So that was pretty cool.
I just learned that a lot of times at least with this person I've been talking to, he's in Baltimore, everything basically that he purchases through the catalog has to be clear. So like his TV is clear, his Xbox is clear. Was your guitar clear?
No, but I remember that. They were just starting to do that in Washington State while I was there. Everything had to be clear. The TVs, the radios, everything. That's just so the staff could see if you're hiding something in your television set or something. But, you know, I'd have my cell searched and, you know, the guitar would just be sitting there and it was pretty easy to search. There was no
right
where you could really hide anything in there. So
were you offered any education?
At one point I went through an anger management course. But that was about it. Mm-hmm. The sad thing is they're really starting to cut out a lot of programs, you know, that would be good for inmates that are doing time. You know, I think they need to bring those programs back because
I agree.
Not all of them are doing life without parole. You know, a lot of these people are going to be free someday. And why not give them the opportunity to learn a skill or a craft or educate themselves.
I agree with that so much. I think that the idea of the justice system when it was originally founded wasn't to be punitive. It was to be rehabilitating. And I think that we've strayed away from that.
I agree.
Did you get any better with the guitar that you had in your cell?
Yeah.
I'm going to need you to play us something someday.
Well, right now I'm a member of the Exoneree band, and I'm...
Oh. Wow, I didn't know that.
Are you going to be at the conference?
Yes, we'll be playing at the conference in Memphis.
Cool.
That's I'm going to need your autograph.
I need my autograph.
So, yes, it's been a great honor to be able to play music with these guys. Because they're also exonerees, and we've all been through very similar experiences, and it's just... it continues that healing. Like I said, you know, music got me through prison. It continues now that I'm free. You know,
it's your release.
Is this your first conference?
This one coming up?
Yes.
No, actually, I've been to probably like 7 or 8 of the conferences.
Were you in San Diego?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was so beautiful.
Hold on. So that one night, I don't remember what day it was on, but it was like a party. And the band that was out there, it was nice too. They had food everywhere, and it was the band that was playing. Were you up there?
Yeah, I was up there.
Wow.
I play bass guitar, so I'm kind of like hiding in the back behind the other guys. So.
Listen, that was so cool last year. When I was in Sydney, man, the Exoneree band, that was cool.
Yeah, great group of guys.
Yeah, well, that was my first one, so I didn't really get the, experience how you experienced it, but, I experienced it in my own way, and it was very cool. It was exciting, and I'm looking forward to this year. I'm looking forward to seeing you and hearing you play and everything.
So I feel like I've strayed a little off track.
Oh, well, yes.
Sorry. You were out on parole, probation / community supervision, and finally was able to get a retrial, even though the appeal court upheld your conviction, but they gave you a retrial. Can you tell me what that retrial was based on?
Sure. The Innocence Project Northwest were working on my case since 2002, and it wasn't until after I was released that we were finally able to get the DNA testing done on the crime scene evidence. And when they were finally able to get that stuff tested, it came back that there was an unknown male contributor to a sample that was left on the crime scene evidence. And it didn't match me. It didn't match the victim's husband. So they made a motion to the court for the right to a new trial based on this new DNA evidence. And in 2006, about a year after I was released, the court granted that motion. They said Mr. Bradford is entitled to a new trial based on this new evidence that wasn't available at the time of his first trial. So I thought this whole thing was done. I thought, okay, I can move on. This part of my life is over. Unfortunately, and fast forward to 2008, I have 2 police officers show up at my door, and they tell me they were there to arrest me for the same charges. I tried talking with them. I was like, why am I being arrested? I've been trying to clear my name for years. Just give me a court date and I'll show up. And they said, well, we're just doing our job. You have to come with us. So they handcuffed me, took me to jail. I spent the night in jail, went to court the next day. And the judge, he was very upset with the prosecutor. For one, the prosecutor didn't even show up to that hearing.
Oh, my gosh.
The judge actually said, why did the prosecutor have this man arrested? He's already done his time. So he released me on OR own recognizance, so I didn't have to post any bail or anything like that, thankfully, because the trial didn't get underway until 2010, so that would have been like almost 2 years of sitting in jail again.
When the retrial happened, how did it go?
Well, on the part of the prosecution, they tried the same old thing. He gave a confession. We believe it's a valid confession, that sort of thing. My attorney's strategy was to show that that confession was false. And the alibi evidence also came in. We also had Dr. Richard Leo testify. He's a scientist, I guess, or he's a professor, but his life is dedicated to false confessions, why they happen and how they happen and what we could do about them.
Oh, like a behavior analyst, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so that second trial, we felt pretty good throughout the whole thing. You know, we felt like everything was working in our favor, even to the point where when that detective, the 6'8" guy, got up on the stand, he launches into, well, Mr. Bradford, we asked him if he wanted to take a polygraph, and he said yes. And my attorney stood up quietly. He says, "Your Honor." And so they sent the jury out. My attorney first was, this officer has, whatever, 20, 30 years on the force. He should know better than to try to introduce polygraph results in a trial because it's not allowed. So my attorney asked for dismissal of charges or, in the alternative, a mistrial, which the judge was going to grant. But my attorneys told me, like, when we were on a break from that, after they sent the jury out, they said, "Look, we got them on the ropes. They know they're losing. I think that's why they brought this detective up there, to intentionally sabotage the case, to have a mistrial. And who knows what will happen with that. They could come at you in like a year or 5 years down the road and recharge you." And my attorney said, "Well, I have a good feeling about this jury. Everything's going great." And he said, "But I leave it up to you. Do you want to accept the judge's mistrial?"
And that means you can be tried again, right?
Right. So I told my attorney, I said, "You know, I trust you completely. I agree. I think that they are just trying something shady here to get this mistrial done so they could come at me later." So we decided to continue on with that trial. And, you know, thankfully we did, because I was finally acquitted.
Amen.
And you said that they only deliberated for 5 hours or less?
Yeah, it was less than 5 hours.
That's awesome.
How long you been out?
I've been out since 2005, so what, coming up on 13 years.
13 years. So how's things going for you now?
I'm still struggling. You know, it's great being exonerated and my name cleared and everything, but I still struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that 10-year gap in my work history made it difficult, and it still makes it difficult to find a job. Since my release, the only thing I've been able to find is like temp work. You know, where you show up and they might have a job for you that might last a day or two, or sometimes a job might last a couple of weeks at a time, that sort of thing.
Yes,
but
I know.
Never anything permanent.
So I heard you refer to your wife at the time in that way. So how are your relationship with your family and others? How have those changed?
It's taken a toll on all of us. Like, for my kids, I think it's really hard for them. And we've reconnected, but, you know, I don't see them as much as I'd like to. But, of course, you know, they're young adults now. They're both in their 20s. So, you know, they got their own lives going on. They got work, school, and that sort of thing. So it's been hard trying to rebuild, you know, what was taken. I don't talk to my ex-wife anymore. I haven't heard from her in quite a while. She was there for the retrial in 2010. Because, like I said, everybody knew I didn't do this, and she's always supported me.
That is hard, though. How do you think that your experience has changed your outlook on life?
For me, I like to think it's changed for the better. Because what I've been through, I've learned to appreciate every day. And I've learned to be at peace with what has happened to me. And now I try to find the bright side of things more and more. Of course, you know, it has taken a toll on me, and I do have times where things seem dark and that sort of thing. But for the most part, I like to think that I've come out of this pretty much okay. I'm happy with who I am now. I'm happy where I'm at in life.
A lot of the people that we talk to tell us that they've been diagnosed or they feel like that they have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you think that, do you have flashbacks or things like that that affect you?
Oh, definitely. I haven't been able to, I think of myself as like undiagnosed PTSD, but I definitely have those moments. Like even going to like a store, like a shopping center or something, I have anxiety like you wouldn't believe, you know, especially like if I'm in line and there's like a dozen people behind me, I have this fear of crowds, especially when I'm like feel boxed in.
What advice would you give to someone who is finding themselves wrongly convicted, wrongly accused, or even convicted of a crime that they didn't commit?
I would say keep your head up and fight, because they can't hide from the truth forever. Thank God there is such a thing as DNA. And even there's a lot of cases now where DNA wasn't a part of the, you know, a person's exoneration, but just, you know, keep fighting. They can't run from it forever.
What advice or what do you think that the listeners to this program who are like me and haven't been wrongly convicted, what can we do to help support people who have been?
A big one would be to donate to the Innocence Projects in your area or your state, because pretty much all of them are ran by donations. There's no government, you know, support for Innocence Projects. So they're mostly donation based. And it takes a lot to, you know, keep these up and running. So every little bit helps. Also just try to be more aware that wrongful convictions can and do happen. You might be sitting on a jury someday and think, oh yeah, I remember something similar like this happened to this person, and it sounds a lot like the same thing. So second guess what the government, like the prosecutors and police, are trying to throw at you. I guess that's about it. Just be aware of wrongful convictions and how they happen, and also spread the word. That's why I'm always glad to do interviews or testify in the legislature, because, you know, also the lawmakers of this land need to hear from people that have been through a wrongful conviction. That's how they start changing the laws. You know, for instance, recording interrogations. They didn't record my interrogation. They only had an audio recording of it after the end of the day when I was already broke down and agreed to make a statement. But they did not record the whole entire day spent with these officers. So things like that, to spread the word.
And we really appreciate your time, because we know that people who have been wrongly in prison know the value of time. So we appreciate that you share your time with us.
Oh, sure. No problem. Thank you guys for having me on.
No, I do. For real. Thank you, man. People, you know, to sit down and share your story. I want people to know that wrongful convictions can happen to anyone. And for you to sit down and share your story, you know, it's greatly appreciated because we do try to spread the awareness of wrongful conviction. So thank you.
I was really surprised. I didn't realize that Ted was part of the Exoneree band. So I'm super excited that I'm going to be able to hear him and meet him at the Innocence Conference.
I know, right? And I was there last year and I actually watched the band. I actually have pictures of the band in my old phone, which I'm going to look through and see if I could find some of those pictures.
And another thing I thought was interesting about Ted's case was I've noticed that a lot of times when an appellate court grants someone a retrial, that the retrial doesn't happen. Either the charges are dropped or there's not enough evidence, but they actually retried Ted. So I thought that that was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm just glad that he beat it. Justice prevailed.
So, until next time. Thank you so much for listening.
You can visit our website for bonus materials like transcripts, pictures, and calendars of upcoming episodes. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Our original music is by Blake Maples. Our transcriptionist is Christina Judge. Our website guru is Sean Cole. Our master of social media is Cameron Taylor. And our amazing volunteer is Casey Weber.